You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On April 3rd, 2014, Rick Britton presented the third lecture in our five-part CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. It has been said that the Civil War was the last of the Napoleonic Wars and the first truly modern war. Although much of the technology used in the American Civil War had been previously invented, it was the first war to see widespread use of such technology. In this podcast, Mr. Britton explains how balloons and submarines were used in the war. Rick also talks about the turtle, the alligator, and gives an account of one idea that went terribly wrong, torpedo mules. Portions of Mr. Britton's lecture were based on the book Arms and Equipment of the Civil War by Jack Coggins. Rick Britton is an historian of the Old Dominion who specializes in 18th and 19th century Virginia history. Two of his main areas of expertise are the American Civil War and the life and times of our third president, Thomas Jefferson. Along with his writing, Rick conducts tours of Civil War battlefields, teaches classes on the history of Central Virginia, organizes history programming for the Senior Center in Charlottesville, and illustrates maps for history books and lectures all across Virginia on a wide range of topics. With over 200 published articles and essays under his belt, he's the author of Albemarle and Charlottesville, an Illustrated History, and Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler, for which he was awarded a medal for nonfiction at the New York City's Book Expo, the nation's largest book convention. The lecture was presented by Rick Britton as a part of this series held in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled, The Civil War Through Different Lenses, Whiz-Bangs and Inventions. Here's Rick Britton.
A lot of the things that I'll be talking about are illustrated here, and if you're wondering, most of these are from this great book, and it's been put out in paperback for the Civil War sesquicentennial. It's Arms and Equipment of the Civil War by Jack Coggins, and it's a great place to start, or even if you're not just starting, because it explains everything in easy-to-understand infantry, cavalry, artillery, machine guns, the Navy, the engineers. It explains all of that really, really well. Arms and Equipment of the Civil War by Jack Coggins. It's about 60 years old, but they just reprinted it in paperback. Okay. So tonight's speaker, I've had the pleasure of knowing my entire life. No lie. The chilly evening of February 17, 1864 began quietly for the vessels of the Federal blockading squadron just outside of Charleston, South Carolina. An unusually bright moon hung low over the picturesque city and its environs, making visibility better than normal. Gliding out of the harbor that night, aided by the powerful ebb tide, was an infernal machine that would make military history, forever changing the nature of naval combat. Calmly gliding the night sea on blockade duty was the USS Housatonic, a well-armed 207-foot-long screw steamer. At 8:45 p.m., acting master J.R. Crosby noticed what looked like a large plank moving toward the vessel, close off the starboard bow. The alarm was immediately sounded. All hands rushed to stations, and a gun crew frantically attempted to bring the after-pivot gun to bear on the strange craft. Everyone familiar with Civil War history has read some version of the following statement. The Civil War was the last of the Napoleonic Wars and the first truly modern war, last of the old, first of the new. Oftentimes accompanying that assertion is a list of the modern gadgets supposedly first used in America's fratricidal war. Balloons, machine guns, railroads, submarines. Let's dispense with a couple of these right off the bat. Napoleon employed military balloons 50 years before the Civil War. And railroads were used to transport troops during the Crimean War in the 1850s that pitted Russia against Turkey and two of its allies, Britain and France. Many writers still claim that the Civil War was the first conflict photographed, whereas that accolade actually belongs to the Mexican War fought between 1846 and 1848. Believe it or not, there are photographs. American photographers accompanied the American troops in the Mexican War. Not a lot. It's more accurate to say that these inventions, balloons, the railroad, and cameras, first saw wide usage during the American Civil War. But what about the other inventions? The Gatling gun is an invention of no ordinary character, wrote Dr. Richard Gatling to President Abraham Lincoln in February of 1864. It is regarded by all who have seen it operate. This is the inventor, so remember that. It is regarded by all who have seen it operate as the most effective implement of warfare invented during the war, and it is just the thing needed to aid in crushing the present rebellion, according to Gatling. By the time this letter was written, the doctor's ingenious rapid-fire weapon had been available to federal forces for well over a year. A working model, in fact, had been demonstrated to the governor of Indiana on July 14, 1862. During the Civil War, many other types of machine guns were also in existence. But here's the most important question, the most important to me as a military historian: were they used in combat? The idea of employing multi-firing or volley-firing engines of war goes back almost as far as the earliest use of gunpowder. The primitive iron multi-barreled, and this is probably French, so you excuse my French, Ribaldiquin, designed to be used against ranks of pikemen, was first described in 1339. For the next 500 years, the development of these types of weapons, by and large muzzleloaders, were held back by the same problems that plagued all firearms. The crude, unreliable gunpowder being used, and you can see how that would be a problem, methods of igniting it, and means of keeping up a frequent rate of fire. This last concern was first successfully addressed by the breech-loading small arms of the early 1800s. The Hall rifle, a breech loader, was patented in 1811 and soon thereafter adopted by the U.S. Army. Some Hall rifles, a breech-loading rifle, in fact, were used in the War of 1812. So that goes back quite a bit before the Civil War. Dozens of other excellent designs quickly followed. Two advancements of the mid-19th century were particularly crucial to the development of Civil War-era machine guns: the introduction of the conical bullet and various new methods of producing cartridges, manufacturing cartridges. The self-consuming cartridge, made of linen, was introduced by Christian Sharps in 1852. Colonel Samuel Colt's version of the self-consuming cartridge, constructed of stiff, durable paper, almost like cardboard, first appeared at the same time, both of those in the 1850s. The concept of combining the detonating charge along with the cartridge also advanced the work of machine gun creators. A method of housing both propellant and detonator in the base of a projectile was first patented in 1856. The volcanic weapons, so weapons using this system, were first called volcanic. The volcanic weapons produced by the Winchester Arms Company relied upon this principle. Smith & Wesson's first successful rimfire metallic cartridge was introduced in 1857. That same year, a former officer of the Belgian Army first adapted the percussion ignition system to a multi-firing machine gun. Two early designs that probably never saw the light of day were the crank-operated Barnes machine cannon, patented by C.E. Barnes of Lowell, Massachusetts, in July of 1856, and the Ripley gun, an 1861 invention of New Yorker Ezra Ripley. Okay, so now we're going to look. No, actually, I don't have the Winans. I thought for a second there was a Winans. Nope, we haven't gotten any of the illustrations yet. Sorry. One of the first machine guns to appear during the Civil War was the bizarre creation of Charles S. Dickinson. Constructed by Ross Winans, a Baltimore locomotive manufacturer, the celebrated Winans steam gun, a huge, ungainly-looking apparatus, could reportedly toss 200 balls per minute over a distance of 2 miles. Now think about how quickly that is, 200 balls per minute. The weapon's one barrel was fed by means of a hopper. The New York Tribune of May 1861 claimed that the boiler, evidently the source of the propellant, was similar to that of an ordinary steam fire engine. 7 years previously, Englishman Sir Henry Bessemer had patented, quote, a self-acting breech-loading gun that used steam to perform the functions of feeding, locking, and firing the piece, unquote, steam. Perhaps Dickinson's weird contraption was based on Bessemer's designs. The one prototype manufactured never saw combat. Although in the early days of the war, many people illustrated it because it was trotted out into the streets of Baltimore. And so it appears illustrations of the Winin steam gun appear early on in the war in 1861. It was captured in Baltimore, May 10, 1861, by members of the 6th Massachusetts Infantry. So obviously they were afraid that this steam gun was going to be used by the secessionists, the Confederates. Now we're going to take a look at this one up here. The Requia battery gun was produced by the Billinghurst Company of Rochester, New York. A 58 caliber version of this volley gun was demonstrated in late 1861 in front of the New York City Stock Exchange building. It had 25 barrels arranged horizontally across a metal platform. The tubes were breech-loaded simultaneously by means of a sliding mechanism and special clips that held all of the cartridges. Now think about that for a moment. 25 barrels, 25 cartridges, and somebody operating this thing is supposed to slide all of those into all 25 barrels simultaneously. Think about that for a moment. Okay, right, exactly. Not gonna happen. The jerk of a lanyard released a single hammer onto a percussion cap, which ignited a long powder-filled channel. A crew of three could reportedly fire the Requia battery gun 7 times per minute at a maximum effective range, estimated, of course, at 1,300 yards. But any moisture in the powder train would render the piece useless, and it was far too cumbersome for field operations. The weapon became known as, quote-unquote, the covered bridge gun. Look at the design. Because proponents believed it perfect for the defense of narrow spans. I mean, if you actually got that thing to fire, it's going to take down everybody that's coming across a narrow span, right? 5 Requia guns were purchased by the federal government at the cost of $5,482. That's over $1,000 a piece. That's a lot of money in those days. And were deployed against Battery Wagner in the Charleston, South Carolina defenses in August of 1863. A Confederate defender reported that the weapons were ineffective because the fort's rifled cannon outranged them. Well, of course. But author Aiken Simmons called the Requia guns, quote, the first machine guns with metallic cartridges used in actual combat. So there it is. That goofy looking thing right there. Goofy is like the word of the night tonight. A more advanced design was that of the Agar, and we don't have one of those. Or is that on the next page? Nope. Coffee mill gun, so called because its top-mounted projectile hopper closely resembled a contemporary coffee grinder. Like a coffee grinder, it was also crank operated. The inventor was Wilson Agar, an American citizen who inexplicably only patented the device in England. That is kind of strange. If you're an American, why wouldn't you patent it in the United States? The Agar could fire either loose powder and 58 caliber projectiles or specially prepared paper cartridges. The ammunition was loaded into steel containers, which were fed via the large hopper into a chamber that revolved behind the breech. Each container had its own rear-mounted nipple that took a standard percussion cap. Since the Agar featured only one barrel, which was rifled, it was designed to fire no more than 120 rounds per minute, but still, 120 rounds per minute. The heat caused by cranking off shots more rapidly, of course, could endanger the weapon and the crew. The gun had a maximum effective range of 1,000 yards when using the recommended mini-style bullet. Lincoln authorized the purchase of 12 of these weapons, officially known as the Union Repeating Gun, in November of 1861, and upon General George B. McClellan's request, 50 more the following month. So this is when Lincoln was still listening to McClellan, remember. They were manufactured by Kerr and Avery of New York, who delivered the first specimen on April 21st, 1862. They were used in several minor skirmishes, but never received the attention they probably deserved. At Reams Station in August of 1864, a Confederate coffee mill piece was fired without effect against a federal observation balloon. And I don't know about y'all, but think about this for a moment. You're up a quarter of a mile in the air, standing in a wicker basket, and shells start flying by you, you would get pretty nervous pretty fast. I would. The Confederacy experimented with several innovative machine guns, one of which, the Williams, and here's the Williams right here, saw action on a number of occasions. Confederate Chief of Ordnance Josiah Gorgas invented a repeating small-bore cannon whose loading mechanism resembled a flat turret. The revolving breech held 18 muzzle-loading chambers which radiated outward. The ammunition, 1.25 caliber, so an inch and a quarter, was fired by means of a central striker and standard rifle musket percussion caps. The only model produced evidently never saw service. A Confederate revolving cannon, which had been used in the Siege of Petersburg, was captured by Federals in Danville, Virginia, in 1865. Another Confederate machine gun was the much-touted Vandenberg volley gun. And we actually saw one, if y'all traveled with us to the Tredegar Museum a couple of years ago, the National Park Service Tredegar Museum, there's one as soon as you enter the main room. And here it is right here. The Vandenberg volley gun, the creation of American O. Vandenberg. The inventor referred to his massive brass breech-loading weapon as, quote, a new system of artillery for projecting a group of cluster shot. A British-made example, which was captured by Federal cavalry at Salisbury, North Carolina, in April of 1865, had 85 barrels. This is the version. 85 barrels in a circular cluster. And there were versions, by the way, with as many as 451 barrels. The overabundance of tubes, however, meant the 45 caliber contraption was slow to load, think about it, extremely heavy, all those barrels, and required 9 man hours to clean. So you're going to shut it down for an entire day after you use it. Yeah. All at once. Right. So why are you going to fire everything at once in a tiny little cluster like that? One guy is going to get a whole lot of stuff right in the chest, and the people on either side of him are going to be fine. Although unsuited for field service, one Vandenberg was nonetheless used in the Siege of Petersburg, while another was purchased by Governor Zebulon Vance of North Carolina. His detractors referred to it as, quote-unquote, Vance's folly. Undoubtedly, the most effective machine gun used by Confederate forces, and here we're going back to the Williams, was the single-barreled Williams rapid-fire cannon. Now, this thing is technically a machine gun, but it's really a cannon. Designed by Captain D.R. Williams of Covington, Kentucky, the Williams gun featured a cranked fore-and-aft breech lock and was able to sustain a fire of 65 1.56 caliber 1-pound rounds per minute. So it's a 1-pounder, 65 a minute. Unfortunately, it had no attached feeder mechanism and was susceptible to overheating. Anytime you pump a whole lot of rounds down one tube, chances are you're going to overheat, right? 12 Williams guns were produced in Lynchburg, Virginia, while 24 more were made at the Tredegar Ironworks in Richmond. Another battery of 6 Williams guns was built in Mobile, Alabama, and served in Confederate General Simon D. Buckner's artillery arm. One battery, and this is the one that interests me the most, because I've read in other places about this, one battery whose operation was overseen by Captain Williams himself, was attached to General George Pickett's brigade during the June 1st, 1862 Battle of Seven Pines. And I've read accounts of the brigade being next to this battery of weird-looking weapons. It reportedly created havoc among the enemy. Captured federal officers later requested to see these Confederate secret weapons. At the October 10th, 1863 Battle of Blue Springs, Tennessee, a battery of Williams guns opened a heavy fire that temporarily stopped a Union advance. Captain T.T. Allen of the 7th Ohio Cavalry was amazed at the rapid fire laid down by these little one-pounders. Now, this one, the illustration, makes it look as big as the Vandenberg gun, but it's not. Remember, the caliber on this barrel here is 1.56, just over an inch and a half. So this barrel here is only about this big around, but the thing is long. It's about 5 feet long, but it's not as big looking at all as the Vandenberg. The most famous machine gun in existence during the Civil War, of course, was the creation of Dr. Richard J. Gatling, born September 12, 1818, in Hertford County, North Carolina. Gatling later claimed he invented the device so that one man could, quote, do as much battle duty as 100, thus eliminating the need for large armies and consequently saving lives. Conceived in 1861, let me say something about that before I go any further. Isn't it kind of interesting? I mean, that sounds very noble, doesn't it? Let's make a weapon of mass destruction and it'll save lives. But what happens? It's the opposite, isn't it? It's the opposite. Conceived in 1861 and patented in 1862, it was designed to defend buildings, causeways, and bridges. The crank-operated Gatling had six revolving barrels, each with its own bolt. The cocking and firing of the piece were performed by cam action. The weapon was originally intended to fire paper cartridges, but Gatling switched to copper-cased rimfire 58-caliber rounds. With the use of a hopper feed, the 1862 Gatling gun could sustain a rate of 200 shots per minute. Now, the Gatling gun actually worked, and it did not overheat as quickly. Why? Well, it has six barrels, so it's putting out as many rounds as some of these others, but it's revolving the barrels, so they're switching up, so they get a chance to cool down a little bit, right? The early attempts to interest the U.S. Ordnance Bureau were disappointing, but Union General Benjamin F. Butler, of all people, purchased 12 guns in 1863 along with cartridges and ammunition at the cost of $12,000, so they were $1,000 a pop. Several were also acquired by the U.S. Navy the same year. During the incredibly violent New York City draft riots of July 13th through 16th, 1863, New York Times editor Henry Jarvis Raymond somehow procured three Gatling guns and strategically placed them in upstairs windows so as to command the lawless streets below. Think about that for a moment. That's pretty odd. Upstairs. They were never fired, luckily. They would have destroyed the crowd. Think about that. In late May 1864, Union Staff Officer Captain Gustavus S. Dana, serving in Butler's Bermuda 100 line, wrote, quote, I saw General Butler testing the Gatling gun, which was a new thing then, upon some rebels who were strolling up and down the top of their earthworks. It brought on quite an artillery duel. So there were some guys, and you know, people would do that on both sides. It's kind of like, you know, walking on the top of earthworks, and somebody would start taking pot shots, and then it would an artillery duel would stop, and that's what happened here. Like the Agar and Williams, the Civil War era Gatling gun was a weapon born too soon. These early machine guns saw combat on occasion, but were rarely effective, simply because the military didn't know how to employ them. It was not until the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-1871 that the world first witnessed the deadly hail of gunfire that massed batteries of machine guns were capable of delivering. And even in the Franco-Prussian War, They weren't that effective, and here's the reason why. To the French, they're called, and maybe somebody pronounces French better than I do, mitrailleux, mitrailleux. Does that sound right to a French speaker out there? Nobody speaks French, okay. Mitrailleux. And what they would do is they would use entire batteries of, say, six of these Gatling guns. Okay, well, what would happen is they'd bring them out on the battle line, the French would, and the Prussians would notice where they are and sit at a distance with rifled cannon and destroy them. So what they ended up doing eventually by the end of the war is take two of the Gatling guns and attach them to a battery of regular artillery, and the Gatling guns then became the defensive arm of that battery, rather than expecting people to be stupid enough to walk into a battery of Gatling guns. Hopefully that's not going to happen. The Civil War was chock full of strange events and unusual devices. Confederate General H.H. Sibley's 1862 invasion of New Mexico and Arizona witnessed some very unusual events, including the war's only mounted lancer charge. Think about that for a moment. But perhaps the strangest was the night attack of U.S. Captain James Paddy Creighton's torpedo mules. So I'm going to let that sink in. Wait for it. It has to be the weirdest assault of the entire Civil War. And I'm getting some strange looks from y'all. Sibley's 2,600 Army of New Mexico, four regiments of mounted infantrymen, began its march up the Rio Grande in early January of 1862. Behind it streamed an overtasked supply train hauled by mules. When Sibley approached Union-held Fort Craig, Paddy Grayson, a soldier in the regular army stationed at the fort, was given permission to raise, quote, an independent spy company from the Mexican peasants living in the area. Independent was a perfect title for Graydon's unit, for Paddy was obviously an independent thinker. Case in point, his method of keeping his numbers up. When his morning report revealed that a certain Juan or Jose had deserted overnight, Captain Graydon would accost the first local he encountered the next day, saying, "Here, Juan Chacon, get into your place. I have a mind to shoot you for desertion." Despite the Mexicans' protests, he would quickly find himself astride a U.S.-branded horse wearing a brand-new suit of Union blue. Three or four of Graydon's Hispanic spies assisted him on the night. This is a true story, folks. Assisted him on the night of February 20th, 1862, in his harebrained attack on Sibley's camp. In preparation, Paddy had filled two wooden boxes with 24-pounder howitzer shells, their fuses removed and replaced with slow match. Now, to understand the story, slow match is basically a fuse, but that's just longer and burns very slow. Okay. His explosives ready, Graydon selected a thoroughly distinctive delivery system. Two old mules whose previous war experience had consisted of hauling supplies for the United States forces stationed along the muddy Rio Grande. With the Confederate campfires flickering from across the river, Graydon and his soldados waded across. The two reluctant mules, each now bearing a box full of howitzer shells, led by guidelines while being encouraged to refrain from braying. Graydon's plan was crazy but simple. When close to the Confederate supply train picket line, where all the Texas mules were gathered, the slow matches would be fired, and the old army mules, attracted by like kind, would naturally rush over to their southern counterparts. In theory, the resulting explosions would leave Sibley seriously short of transportation muscle. But theory and reality, of course, are oftentimes polar opposites. At a distance of 150 yards from Sibley's camp, Paddy and his spies lit the slow matches, pointed the torpedo mules at their intended target, then lit out in the opposite direction. Much to their chagrin, however, their mules, instead of trotting toward the enemy, were eagerly following them in retreat. This realization, no doubt, greatly encouraged Graydon and his Hispanics in their flight. When the shells exploded, the southern camp was quickly under arms, and Graydon's party returned to Fort Gregg, sans its four-legged friends. The failed attack, however, was not a total disaster. That night, many of the Southern horses and mules stampeded. Perhaps due to the spy company's efforts, over 200 were reportedly captured and brought into the fort. Perhaps it's safe to say that the Civil War witnessed the only known use of torpedo mules. Some Civil War gadgets were more exotic than others. And for this story, I owe the assistance of my friend sitting right there, Cheryl. Some Civil War gadgets were more exotic than others, such as the one devised by William C. Powers. And we're going to see this on the middle of this page right here. In 1862, most of the southern ports were completely blockaded by Union naval forces. Powers was an architectural engineer living in Mobile, Alabama, where he personally saw the effects of the northern blockade. Powers knew that the Confederacy didn't have enough ships to break through the blockade, so he dreamed up another way to attack it from the air. Using his engineering skills, Powers drafted plans for a machine that could lift off and propel itself through the atmosphere. Yeah, take a look at it. Leonardo would be proud. Although balloons were being effectively used for observation, they lacked directional control and could not lift enough weight to make effective bombers. Powers drew upon the work of other famous engineers, such as Archimedes and Da Vinci, and employed Archimedean screws for lift and thrust, all of these things powered by a steam engine. The engine was located in the middle of the craft and used two smokestacks. Two Archimedean side screws gave the helicopter forward thrust, and two mounted vertically gave it lift. A rudder was added to the rear of the craft for steering. See it? After drafting his plans, Powers built a small model, and there it is. This is the photograph of the model. A full-scale version was never attempted, according to Powers' family lore. Listen to this. For fear that it would be captured by federal forces, mass-produced, and used to rain destruction on southern armies and cities. Needless to say, these fears, if they're even true, were based on the inventor's ego and not on reality. Meanwhile, back in Charleston Harbor, where this presentation began, the federal sailors were vainly attempting to stave off a strange gadget approaching in the water. The strange plank, as they referred to it, was mounted with a 14-foot-long torpedo-tipped spar, a lance of sorts, with an explosive punch at the end. It struck the Housatonic just forward of the mizzenmast, in line with the powder magazine. Uh-oh. A powerful explosion ripped a hole at the waterline and shook the Yankee tars to the deck. Booms and coils of rigging crashed down from above. The USS Housatonic sank quickly, stern first, and heeling to port. She became an important historical first, the first ship ever sunk by a submarine. It was a Pyrrhic victory for the Confederate Navy, however. The underwater antagonist, the CSS H.L. Hunley, also went to the bottom that night, carrying with her all hands. The idea of attacking warships under the waterline was nothing new. David Bushnell made just such an attack in New York Harbor during the Revolutionary War. In his one-man turtle, he attempted to drill a hole in a British warship in Boston Harbor. The English vessel was protected by a copper bottom, however, and the attempt failed. And speaking of this, this reminded me, my wife Victoria and I met this crazy but fascinating artist from New York City. What's this guy's name? Duke Riley. Duke Riley loves all things nautical. And Duke Riley, about 10 years ago, using David Bushnell's designs, manufactured a full-scale working model of the turtle. Now, think about how crazy this idea was, but it got him in national headlines, though. And put it in the water in New York Harbor without telling anybody, and then started... Now think about this, 10 years ago, and started making his way out into the harbor. Now there are all these kinds of vessels out there, so there was a major alarm. you know, is this a terrorist one-man submarine coming towards, you know, what is it, the ferry boat that takes people out to Staten Island or, you know. So the U.S. Coast Guard actually arrested him. He made it on the front page of the New York Times, and there's a photograph of him getting hauled out of this little one-man thing that's kind of bobbing in the water next to a Coast Guard cutter. It's just hilarious. In early, I mean, you can see him just saying, but, Bushnell did the same. You don't recognize the turtle. In early 1862, the Federal Navy built a powerful 40-foot-long submarine in Philadelphia, the U.S. Navy. The Alligator, as it was called, was designed to sink the Confederate ironclad Virginia, then being constructed in Norfolk. It was made of steel and featured an air purifier and a sealed compartment from which divers could sortie. It was propelled by its 16-man crew working hand cranks. This product of Yankee ingenuity never saw action, however. The Alligator was lost in a storm as it was being towed into Chesapeake Bay in June of 1862. And everybody thought that this was the final word, that the Alligator was lost forever. But about 15 years ago, in a junkyard in New Jersey, somebody found a version of the Alligator. Now, if it's the original one, or it's a copy, a sister ship of the original one, but it matches all of the dimensions and all the characters. Isn't that neat? In a junkyard in New Jersey. Who knew, right? The story of the Confederate submarine service begins in New Orleans in early 1862. On March 29th, Robert R. Barrow, Baxton Watson, and James R. McClintock applied for a letter of marque for an underwater vessel they called the Pioneer. Listed as a guarantor for the experimental vessel was Horace L. Hunley, a man who would soon be known worldwide. The three-man craft was 20 feet long, 4 feet deep, and 4 feet wide. She was fabricated of 1/4-inch thick iron sheets bolted together with countersunk rivets. Like the Alligator, the Pioneer's propeller was turned by hand cranks. Two side fins controlled the limited diving done by the ship. With its conical ends and weight of 4 tons, the Pioneer must have drawn quite a few stairs while it was under construction. What is that thing? This submarine's mode of attack was unique. A floating powder magazine, or torpedo, was dragged along on a tow line, so it's pulling something. The Pioneer was designed to dive under the enemy ship, pulling the torpedo into contact with its hull. Everybody follow me? There's a lot to say for this system of delivering an explosion rather than having it on the tip of a spar at the front of the vessel. There's a lot to be said. Contact detonators would then cause the device to explode. In experiments, the Pioneer successfully destroyed a barge, but her career was cut short. She was sent to the bottom by her creators to prevent her capture by federal forces when New Orleans fell. Hunley, McClintock, and Watson moved on to Mobile to continue work on submarines. Readily available Alabama iron and the well-equipped metalworking shop of Parks and Lyons made Mobile an attractive base of operations. The large, well-defended harbor was also ideal for their experiments. Volunteer engineers were sent over from the 21st Alabama Infantry to lend technical expertise. Their first Mobile-built submarine sank while being towed out into the harbor to attack the blockaders. Not a good start, right? So the first one goes right down. The next submarine they constructed was christened the H.L. Hunley. The Hunley, lying at dry dock, resembled a series of boilers and still does, a series of boilers attached end-to-end. She's 35 feet long and about 5.5 feet wide. Two manholes set 14 feet apart rise 16 inches from the top of the body. The building of the Hunley was one adaptation after another. She was originally designed to house a steam engine for propulsion. And how many of y'all in the room came with us when we went to see the Hunley? Originally designed to house a steam engine, but it was soon found impossible to get enough air below to feed the boiler fires. The Hunley went on her only mission, therefore, powered just like her predecessor, her large screw propeller blades rotated by the exertions of 8 crew members. She was at first created to tow a torpedo, just like her predecessor. The long cable was so cumbersome, however, that a torpedo-tipped 14-foot spar was mounted on its bow instead. For ballast, the Hunley carried a false keel of cast iron that was easily detachable. Water compartments at either end served as auxiliary ballast and provided trimming. She carried a crew of 1 officer, 1 petty officer, and 7 seamen. The Hunley was a cantankerous and risky vessel to operate. Her nickname, the American Diver, proved ironic. During trial runs, she showed an ugly propensity for taking on water and diving to the bottom. In all, 3 crews, 17 men, were lost on experimental cruises. Hunley himself rode his ungainly creation to his death. While the Hunley was being tested in Mobile, a collection of similar-looking vessels were operating in Charleston Harbor. The so-called Davids were a class of steam-powered torpedo boats designed to ride low in the water. They took advantage of their virtual invisibility at night to deliver their torpedoes spar-mounted into the vulnerable underwater hull of federal warships. They were not created to actually maneuver underwater, however, so they're not considered true submarines. On October 5th, 1863, one of the Davids steamed out of the harbor to take on a Goliath, the federal gunboat New Ironsides. The Confederate vessel carefully picked her way through the blockading fleet in search of her prey. The David exploded her torpedo 6 feet beneath the enemy vessel about 9 p.m. Acting engineer J.H. Toome reported that, quote, "the column of water thrown up was so great that it recoiled upon our frail bark in such force as to put the fires out and lead us to suppose that our little vessel would sink." The federal ironclad was not sunk, however, but an investigation showed considerable damage to the hull. The David braved a storm of federal shot and shell to make it safely back up the channel to Charleston. Because of the importance of Charleston, Confederate General P.G.T. Beauregard ordered the Hunley there in early 1864. She made the trip from Mobile on a railroad flat car. That must have been kind of interesting to see. After a few tests in the harbor, she set off on her first mission the night of February 17th. Lieutenant George E. Dixon, Alabama State Troops, was in command. The sinking of the U.S. Housatonic sent shockwaves through the Federal Navy. Quote, "The department will readily perceive the consequences likely to result from this event," read the Federal report. "The whole line of blockade will be infested with these cheap, convenient, and formidable devices," meaning submarines, "and we must guard every point." The Union Navy had less to fear than was first imagined, however. The underwater devils, these newfangled submarine gadgets, were just as fatal to their own crews as they were to the blockaders. Perhaps the explosion that tore a hole in the Housatonic also damaged the Hunley, or perhaps in his retreat back into Charleston Harbor, Lieutenant Dixon made some fatal mistake. We might never know the truth. But the Hunley, of course, instead of cranking back to Charleston, nose-dived into the bottom, taking with it its entire crew. Despite this Pyrrhic victory, the world took note, but a repeat performance would take quite some time. It would be 50 years. It wasn't until 1914 before another ship would be sunk by a submarine. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.